Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Xfinity Mobile, featuring customized wireless plans. Customers can choose unlimited, buy the gig, shared data, or a mix of both and switch it up anytime. Learn more at xfinitymobile.com.
From KQED in San Francisco and Public Radio International, it's Pacific Time. I'm Juan Ha. On today's show, China cleans up its pollution and finds there's money to be made. And viva Las Vegas. That's what a lot of Asian Americans are humming these days.
Gaming is kind of inherent in the Asian cultures, and they look to that as a leisure and activity.
Pacific Time, your passport to Asia and America. Welcome to Pacific Time. I'm Juan Ha.
Free Burma! Free! Free! Free Burma! Free! Free! Free Burma! Free! Free!
The rally in San Francisco was small, but the 50 protesters, most of whom are natives of Burma, were passionate. They're hoping for a peaceful end to the turmoil in their homeland, where Buddhist monks and civilians are in a standoff with the military. And the rally is also a message for their countrymen.
We are supporting, we are encouraging you, and still fight for freedom. We are controlled by the Buddha law, okay? We are guided by the monk, okay? We are follow the monk, whatever they say.
A decade ago, Saw Myint Mar left Burma, running away from the junta government that still rules the country. She was jailed for 3 years because she advocated for democracy in the last uprising in 1988. Then 3,000 people were killed. This past week, she's been glued to the internet to find out the fate of friends protesting the military government, which calls the country Myanmar. Blood has been spilled again. Several civilians, including monks, have been killed. Hundreds of monks have been arrested. Emotions boiled over after the government suddenly raised the price of fuel in the poor country, and demonstrations have escalated over the last month. Penny Edwards is professor of Southeast Asian history at the University of California at Berkeley. She says that Buddhist monks play a special role in Burmese society.
The role of the monks is to assist the population, in a sense, in generating merit. I'm putting it in very crude terms here. And merit, you can think of it as a spiritual currency that will help your path to a better afterlife. And the way that you gain merit, there are several ways. But one of the primary ways is by giving alms and making donations to monks. So in that sense, monks act as sort of moral guardians of society.
So the fact that these monks are out there protesting, how is that perceived by the people?
It would be perceived by the people as a sign of a very strong rejection of the government on the part of the monkhood, and it would be particularly significant in the last 17 years since the protests of 1988 and then a small round of short-lived protests by monks in 1990, where they used a similar tactic of a boycott, whereby they upturn their arms bowls. And when you upturn your arms bowls, the symbolism there is that they're refusing to accept arms from anyone in the military government. So since that time, the government, in an effort to sort of co-opt the monkhood, realizing that they are a strong social force, has actually invested an enormous amount of money in material renovations of temples. It's tried to promote itself, you know, as a strong patron and sponsor of Buddhism and as a strongly Buddhist government, and it's done so through material sponsorship. So for the monks now to be protesting against the very government that has been claiming to be a great patron of Buddhism is really, well, it would be taken as a huge insult by the government.
You know, there does seem to be some cloak of protection if you are in the monkhood. Is there any possibility that perhaps, you know, some pro-democracy leaders or activists are, for the time being, part of the monkhood for those protections?
That's a very interesting point. And historically, temples and monasteries have offered, you know, a place of refuge and a sanctuary for those who are seeking refuge from the law. But what has also happened, I believe, in the last 15 or so years is that agents, surveillance agents working for the government have been stationed around various monasteries to try and put a cap on any of this kind of activity. Clearly, given what's been happening in the last 5 days and that it's not been a foolproof strategy. But what is also interesting about Burma is with the Sangha of that size and the only other institution that equals it in size in the country is indeed the army. Some families in Burma, it's not as clear-cut as black and white as one may think. Some may have a member of the family who is a monk and a member of the family who is serving in the army.
Penny Edwards is professor of Southeast Asian history at the University of California at Berkeley. Most countries in the United Nations Security Council had wanted to impose sanctions on Burma this week, but China nixed the idea. China is Burma's main economic benefactor and has been sympathetic to Burma's authoritarian regime. Beijing has been criticized by the international community for not publicly condemning Burma's use of violence. But of course, that's not the only reason why China gets criticized these days. Many are upset over its record on pollution and energy consumption. China has overtaken the U.S. to become the world's largest producer of carbon dioxide emissions. Last year, it failed to meet its own targets to curb pollution. Jocelyn Ford visited several regions and found that in some places, the tide is beginning to turn.
Wang Wei-cheng sits on the Environmental Protection Committee at China's National Congress. But on this day, he's taking a gallery tour in an artist's village an hour outside of Beijing. Congressman Wang admits he doesn't understand much about art. He's an engineer specializing in thermal energy applications.
Energy.
Okay.
Thermal energy.
He's come to the gallery because he believes the artist's village may have a clue for tackling China's severe environmental problems.
We want to reduce our reliance on manufacturing industries, especially in Beijing. So we've come to look at the culture industry that's developing here.
Not too long ago, in the days of the Chinese Cultural Revolution, Western art was banned and considered spiritual pollution. Today, the art industry is seen as an antidote to industrial pollution. China's ruling Communist Party has moved the environment higher up on the list of national priorities. It started linking promotions in the party to pollution control and energy conservation. And there are signs some local officials are taking note. Take the city of Dalian. This month it hosted the summer meeting of the World Economic Forum, which is most famous for its winter meetings of CEOs in Davos, Switzerland. In the past, Chinese local governments would have seen the onslaught of more than 1,000 foreign CEOs as a golden opportunity to sell them on building more factories. But this time, Dalian dispatched the head of the City Environmental Protection Bureau, Liang Hongjun, to speak at a business breakfast on eco-friendly technology. Liang handed out a glossy booklet with 11 projects seeking foreign partners, projects to clean up toxic soils and monitor dioxin in the water supply. Liang says Dalian citizens are getting wealthier and less tolerant of pollution, just as it happened in the U.S. 30 to 40 years ago.
Our residents need a better place for living. We do not like to live among the factories, and it's bad for us. And second of all, some of these factories occupy a very important place in the city. They occupy some really valuable estate. We want to better use that estate, that land.
Among his audience, Shanghai-based investment banker and venture capitalist Andrew Chen. Chen says foreign VC funds invest about $20 billion a year in China, and they're ever more bullish on clean energy and other environmental technologies.
Maybe 5 years ago, there was less than 5% of total private equity funds that invest in this sector. Today, we see 10, 15%. So over the past 3 or 4 years, it's 100% growth for these industries.
The World Economic Forum held a half dozen sessions related to the environment. But in the corridors of the flashy new conference center, Chinese entrepreneur Zhang Yue, who makes energy-efficient air conditioners, told me a lot of the hype is, well, hype. He pointed to the air conditioning unit stuck at the top of the center's high glass ceiling. He said they would have saved so much energy by putting it lower down. Zhang told me he loses a lot of deals because energy efficiency isn't a priority for Chinese businesses. Even saving money in the long run isn't the top priority. He says too many customers buy from whoever gives them the best kickbacks. He says China needs to introduce incentives like tax breaks for green technology. And some current policies encourage wasting resources, such as one of the basics.
China's water prices are 80 to 85% below countries that have four times more water per capita.
John McAllister has spent the past 7 years trying to promote cost-effective industrial wastewater treatments for Chinese factories. He says water is so cheap, factories are encouraged to squander it rather than use it wisely. He says it's part of an old-fashioned approach to the environment.
It is part of a mentality that the destruction of nature is a good thing because it leads to prosperity.
But even in some remote corners of China, there is evidence that mentality is beginning to turn around out of necessity.
We are descending now. Please return your seat back and table to the upper page.
A team of international business consultants is preparing to land at a small airport, several hours' drive from China's border with Mongolia. On hand to greet them is Li Jingye, the Deputy Communist Party Secretary from Arashan. He drove 3 hours from his small hot spring town of 7,000, located next to a volcanic geological park. It's like a remake of The Seven Samurai. The young Communist Party cadre has invited the international advisors to visit his village in hopes he can convince his fellow cadres to reject investors who want to build a cement plant and a quarry. He's asked the consultants to present an alternative tourism development plan that will protect the delicate but deteriorating ecosystem. Then Li Jingye brought us to the geological park. Li Jingye explains that its once roaring river has already shriveled to a stream. He believes it's a result of global warming, overlogging, and overgrazing. He knows he can't restore the river, but he can try to stop further destruction. And he says he's willing to try, even if it means a longer road to prosperity for his village. For Pacific Time, I'm Jocelyn Ford in Arashan, Inner Mongolia.
Coming up, casinos find a winning formula, Asians and gambling. And we've saved you a front seat to a nail-biter of a race between dragons. You're listening to Pacific Time on PRI, Public Radio International. The city of Garden Grove in Southern California is debating a proposal to bring a casino resort to its suburbs. Many immigrants from Southeast Asia have made the town their home, and at a city meeting last month, 500 Vietnamese Americans came out to protest the plans. The controversy highlights a trend. More and more casinos have figured out that Asian American gamblers are a gold mine, and community leaders are concerned about the impact. Las Vegas and even small casinos are courting Asians in the U.S. and abroad like never before. From Los Angeles, Lenora Chu examines the stakes of the game.
One weekday in July, the 8 a.m. bus from Los Angeles to Harrah's Rincon Casino was so packed, the driver had to turn away a dozen people. Those lucky enough to make it on board were hoping that their fortune would stay with them on the casino floor. For the 90-minute ride to the San Diego area, most took catnaps, probably dreaming of dollar signs. As they step off the bus, a casino employee checks their ID and hands over a $5 gaming coupon. Each customer is greeted by name. Many surnames are Asian.
Miss Okazaki, how you doing today? It sure is good seeing you today, Miss Okazaki. Okay. And I hope you have a whole lot of good luck today, all righty.
As the gamers walk into the casino, the sights and sounds erupt around them. The Asian restaurant Fortunes flaunts its noodle specials. A team of Asian hostesses wave at the guests. The hostesses speak Mandarin, Cantonese, Japanese, Vietnamese, Tagalog, and Korean. Neon signs flash above the Pai Gao and the Baccarat tables. These are games made popular in the U.S. by Asian players. At one Pai Gao poker table, Chinese guests are standing three deep behind the players. And it's only 10 o'clock on a Thursday morning. Mike Stratton heads up marketing for Harrah's Rincon. He says competition for the Asian dollar is hot because, on average, Asians spend more of their disposable income on gaming than any other ethnic group.
Gaming is kind of inherent in the Asian cultures, and they look to that as a very valid form and entertaining form of leisure and activity, whereas a Hispanic or a Westerner may not choose to use as much of their discretionary budget on gaming. So it's based on the culture and what they enjoy to do.
Harrah's Rincon has elevated Asian marketing to an art form. It places ads in Asian language newspapers like Tsingtao Daily and the World Journal. It advertises in weekly flyers at 99-cent ranch stores and ABC supermarkets. The casino sponsors the Miss Asia USA pageant and partners with the Asian business associations of L.A., San Diego, and Orange County. That's not all. They also set up booths at Chinese New Year and Tet festivals all over Southern California. And almost a dozen times a year, Harrah's will headline Asian singers and bands to draw in the home crowds. They've also conducted studies on the habits of Asian gamers and may soon be reconfiguring their gaming pits to include Asian food restaurants very close by.
What we see is that the Asian gamer likes to gamble and they like to eat, and they want to eat fast, so they'll go and eat, and they'll eat their food, and they'll come back. And that's just part of their culture. That's who they are. That's the way that they do things.
Harrah's has even introduced what they call cultural sensitivity training to teach their employees, from card dealers up to executives, how to serve their Asian guests. On the casino floor, Albert Lee explains lesson number one. Present your business card with both hands.
The business card represents you as a person, and if you take the card from them with both hands as well, it's a sign of respect taking it back from them.
Lee heads up Harrah's special Asian marketing division. 5 years ago, the department had a single employee. Now there are eight. Lee's sole mission is to increase the Asian business at Harrah's Rincon.
Asians are also very superstitious. You never walk up to somebody that's Chinese while they're gambling and tap them on the back. You know, that's considered bad luck, taking away their luck. So we instructed our beverage servers and most front of house people that when you're approaching an Asian guest, don't walk up to them and tap on the back like you would normally. Tap them on the elbow to get their attention.
Casinos practice these marketing tactics for every level of Asian consumer, whether it's the middle class Asian American on a day trip from San Diego or the international gamer who's come to America on a gambling holiday. In the high-limit industry, it's well known that of every five high rollers who come to Las Vegas, four are from Asia. They're known as whales, players willing to bet 50 grand on a single hand or risk a couple million over a single weekend. Greg Shulman is VP of International Marketing for MGM Mirage, which owns Bellagio and MGM Grand.
The Asian segment of our international gaming revenue stream comprises a very healthy 75%. That's where all the money is right now. A lot of the new wealth, especially in mainland China, when you have an economy that's growing at 8% per annum.
At Bellagio, a customer wanting fresh abalone at 4 in the morning has a staff of Asian chefs at his command. At the Venetian, executives travel to Hong Kong to consult feng shui masters on new suite designs. And at Wynn Las Vegas, no floor starts with a number 4. Elevator buttons skip from floor 39 right up to floor 50. Why? In Chinese superstition, the number 4 signifies death. On the bus home from Harrah's, there's evidence that the promotions are working. Dorothy San Miguel just finished up an afternoon at the slot machines. Her eye catches a flyer promoting a Filipino pop concert at Harrah's next month.
This is Lani Milocha and Sight of Seven. Oh, when is this? Oh, I never know. It's in Harrah's? In Harrah's? Oh, really? Yeah, we're going. I'm going.
On a day trip, San Miguel will drop about $100 on slots. But when there's a Filipino concert, she'll bring her daughter and even book a hotel room.
Oh, can I have this? Just this one, and then I'll show to my...
With that, she shoves the flyer into her purse. Her next trip back to Harrah's has already been scheduled. For Pacific Time, I'm Lenora Chu in Los Angeles.
Tune in next week for a profile of former gamblers who are helping others fight the addiction. Dragon boat racing is a sport that originated in China thousands of years ago, and it's grown quite a following in the U.S. Long, thin boats decorated with colorful dragon heads and tails can be found battling it out in festivals from California to New York, Minnesota, and Texas. The city of San Francisco is home to the largest dragon boat race in the nation, with more than 2,500 paddlers from across North America. It's big among high school students, too. Pacific Times' Mina Kim followed the high school defending champions, the Lincoln Mustangs. She first caught up with them on their last practice before race day.
My name's Vanessa Tam. I'm 14. And, oh, man, I'm never going to give up on this team. My cousin is the one who introduced me to this place. And I was like, oh, I'm a little scared. But she's like, don't worry, this is like a family. So I tried it out. I started to like it. And my coaches used to make fun of me because of my voice.
Why did they make fun of your voice?
Because I was always loud and talkative. So that's probably one good thing about it. And people who are soft or quiet in this boat, they get out of their shells. They're out of there. Yeah.
Yo, we gotta keep it strong. Let's go. Hey, stop. Time it up. Keep it strong. How much do you want it?
My name's Jen Yi, and I go to Lincoln High School.
My name's Sony Tang, and I go to Lincoln High School. I guess one of the good, cool things about it is, we don't get a meet or a competition every week or every month. It's like every season there's one giant race, so that's cool.
But I'd say the only bad thing about it is that it's only 2 minutes, you know, and all months of training, and it all just comes down to 2 minutes on water. So it's really
go big or go home.
Yeah, that concept.
You guys are breaking away pretty good at the end. Okay, but are you breaking away at the start?
My name is Casey Chow, and I'm 16 years old. I'm one of the co-captains on the Lincoln High Gold Boat. Yeah, actually, I want to learn more about sport because of my heritage, because I'm Chinese too. So then, I want to learn more about my heritage, and then I thought the dragon boat would be a good way to do it with my friends and just learn more about it. We haven't lost in 2 years straight right now, 4 races, and we want to keep that reputation up for ourselves. So a lot of these guys are hungry for the win.
We've got coming up next, Heat 67, which is the Comcast Mixed Rec B Championship.
This is it. Last race of the day.
Yeah.
Last race. You have as much rest as you want. You got months of rest after this race. So are you going to save anything?
No.
Are you going to save anything?
No.
All right. And we'll look down. Look at your jerseys, if you guys can. Look around. See that symbol right there? That's what you're wearing. You ran out with pride, all right? That's what you're going to represent today. Representing Mustangs, representing Lincoln. You have a streak right now. We're not going to end it, all right?
All right, so here's the lineup for the AAA High School Division A Championship. In lane, we have Wash House 1. In lane 2, Low Red Tide. In lane 3, CYC Team A. In lane 4, Lincoln Gold. In lane 5, the other Lowell team, the Cardinal Cruisers. And in lane 6, Lincoln Red.
Jim, think about it. For 2 centuries, this battle
they are holding water. Drummers, are you ready? Here we go! And they are it! Heat 75 for the AAA High School Division A Championship. It is a clean start. It's too close for half to call. Who's out front? Is it lane 3 with the CYC team? I don't know.
And just past halfway mark, it looks like Lincoln Gold in lane 4 is in the lead. Lincoln Gold in the yellow. yellow boat. But here comes CYC Jim in their red boat. Number three, CYC, here they come.
They're giving them a fight. They're fighting, Ward. This is the battle we wanted.
Old Carter Cruiser's in third, but here they come. As they reach the stretch down, the stretch they come. Here comes CYC. Oh, my goodness. CYC in boat number three, the red boat. They're taking the lead over Lincoln.
Last 10 meters. Let's give them all a big hand for those great races. That was Division B and C.
I'm like cramping up all over the place.
Thank you, man.
Good
job. Good job. Good job. Yo, like I said, that was like the closest race. Like seriously, neck to neck, neck to neck, neck to neck. You know, you guys were like probably like that far. You know, it's less than a second, isn't it? I'm sure it's less than a second. Yeah, 0.4. See? So don't worry about it. You guys hold your heads high. All right? You're still top two, right? Am I right? Top two. And it's always been that way. Top two, top two, top two. Let's go. Hands in.
One, two, three, team!
What an upset. The Mustangs are looking to reclaim their title next year. If you want to see photos of these Dragon Boat racers, visit our website, kqed.org/pacific time. It's time for us to say so long for this week. Our theme music was composed by Anthony Brown with the Asian American Orchestra. Visit us on the web at kqed.org/pacific time. Got a story idea or a comment on something you heard here? Email us, pacific time@kqed.org. Our staff includes Nina Thorson, Nguyen Quyduc, Danny Bringer, Seal Muller, Susie Rocho, Mina Kim, Helen Lee, Michelle Cheng, Wang Pei, Michelle Lei, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Juan Ha. Thanks for tuning in.